There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the House of Cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Jesse James was an American outlaw, bank and train robber, and leader of the James Younger Gang, raised in the little Dixie area of western Missouri. And James and his family maintained strong southern sympathies. He and his brother Frank James joined pro-Confederate bushwhackers, as they were called, operating in Missouri and Kansas during the American Civil War, and were followers of William Quantrill and Bloody Bill Anderson, according to legend. We're going to separate some fact from fiction a little bit later. They were accused of committing atrocities against Union soldiers and civilian abolitionists, including a massacre that supposedly took place in 1864, the Centralia Massacre. After the war, as members of various gangs of outlaws, Jesse and Frank robbed banks, stagecoaches, trains across the Midwest, gaining national fame and often popular sympathy. And the James brothers were most active as members of their own gang from about 1866 until 1876, when as a result of their attempted robbery of a bank in Northfield, Minnesota, several members of the gang were captured or killed. They continued in crime for several years afterwards, recruiting new members, but came under increasing pressure from law enforcement seeking to bring them to justice. And then, according to the official narrative, on April 3rd, 1882, Jesse James was shot and killed by Bob Ford, a new recruit to the gang who hoped to collect a reward on James' head and a promised amnesty for his previous crimes. Already a celebrity in life, James became a legendary figure of the Wild West after his death. So, how much of the legend surrounding Jesse James is true? The story of James' assassination at the hands of Bob Ford has been clouded with mystery ever since its inception. And tonight, James' great-great-grandchildren, Daniel and Teresa Duke, present the results of more than 20 years of exhaustive research into state and federal records, photographs, newspaper reports, diaries, a 1995 DNA test in search of the truth behind Jesse James' demise. They'll explain how the accepted version of the history of Jesse James is wrong. The authors confirm their family's oral tradition that James faked his own death in 1882 and lived out his remaining days in Texas. And they methodically unravel the legend surrounding his death with evidence vetted by qualified experts and civic authorities. They share the journal of their great-great-grandfather, kept from 1871 to 1876 and verified to be written in James' own handwriting. They reveal forensically confirmed photographs of James before and after his supposed killing, including one of James attending his own funeral. And we'll discuss how this train and bank robbing ancestor, again, faked his death in 1882, lived out his remaining years as a wealthy farmer in Texas. And we may have time to discuss his previously unknown connections to other historical figures, secret societies, lost treasures, and hidden agendas. Teresa and Daniel Duke are writers, researchers, and again, the great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James and co-authors of The Mysterious Life and Fake Death of Jesse James. Daniel Duke is the author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure and the brand new book, Secret History of the Wild, Wild West. Teresa and Daniel Duke, welcome. How are you?
Thanks for having us on the show.
My pleasure. You're both in different parts of Texas tonight, I understand.
Yes, sir.
I gave a bit of a brief summary of Jesse James, but we need to separate fact from fiction. Let's start with his early years and then the post-Civil War years. Who wants to start with that one?
I'm more than happy to do that.
Okay, Daniel.
Jesse, the traditional history on when, how he started out, we've never differed on. It's, he was a young boy when the Civil War, actually fighting before the Civil War had ever started, had started in Missouri and in western Missouri and eastern Kansas along the border, almost 10 years before the official beginning of the Civil War. And it was it was mostly fighting between slavery and anti-slavery states. So, there were people involved in the politics of both on both sides. And they started raiding back and forth of the infamous John Brown, who would kill people and free their slaves. But there was a lot of fighting about a decade before that had started. Around just after the start of the Civil War, Frank James, who was the older brother of the two, he took off. He joined the Confederate Army. He was fighting guerrillas from Kansas, they called them Red Legs, had ridden onto the James farm, and Jesse, who was too young to fight, with the Confederate Army. He was plowing in his field on the family farm, and the Red Legs were said to have strapped him to his plow and beat him severely. They rode to the house. They beat his mother. And accounts vary on, she was pregnant at the time, but accounts vary on how severe she was beat. Some said she was just pushed around. Others said they strapped her to a tree and horsewhipped her. But they did hang the stepfather, not until he was dead, but until he had brain damage. They said they were looking for Frank and nobody would tell, so they made them pay. Well, Jesse, that was a rough area in a different time. He wanted revenge, and he tried to join the army. They wouldn't let him. He was too young. And he finally found a group who would let him join, and that was Quantrell's guerrillas. He proved to have been good at what he did. They trained him well, and they killed a lot of people. I mean, it was bad on both sides, but at the time, it wasn't so much with Jesse, it wasn't so much politics as just protecting his family and getting vengeance.
Right. So his sympathies with the South had nothing to do with the whole question about slavery or abolition. It had more to do with vengeance for the way that the Union soldiers had treated his own family.
Exactly. Right.
It was survival at that point.
Right.
They were treated so bad and harassed and so at that point it was just more just survival. More than about the slavery and choosing sides. They were just fighting to live.
Right. And there's a wonderful diary entry from in the book that Jesse's mother wrote about sending him off on a horse. What was he, 14 or 15? Just this skinny little kid. And he came back, a couple years later, and she didn't even recognize him except for his blue eyes.
He grew into manhood before he was officially a man, but he was bigger than most men at the time. And another example I wanted to mention on that, the political side of it, like Cole Younger and the Younger brothers, who later joined the James gang and became part of the James Younger gang, they were Union supporters until Union-backed guerrillas from Kansas murdered their father and robbed and murdered him. And then they torched the Younger's home later and burned their home down. And that's when Cole Younger and the Younger brothers had joined up with Quantrill's guerrillas also, just looking for revenge. Instead, it wasn't really politics with them and a lot of other people in that area. It was more survival.
During the Civil War, Jesse was shot and received an injury to his lung, not once, but twice, I believe, correct?
He was trying to surrender. And that was the other thing. They did try to do the right thing. They were going to surrender, but he got shot. And, they were trying to just kill him, but they were trying to do the right thing. And they were just kind of forced into doing the outlaw life that they led.
Right. So after the end of the Civil War, Frank and Jesse are they still with the guerrillas at that point? The Quantrill Rangers, I think, as they were known.
Yeah, they were with Quantrill's guerrillas up until the very end, and then all the guerrillas separated and went their own ways. After that, a lot of them went to Texas, which is the direction Frank and Jesse went later. Jesse settled in Texas permanently, but that was years later. It was most of the guerrillas were, if they turned themselves in, they were usually executed in one way or another. And if they didn't turn themselves in, they were hunted down and executed that way as well. So,
right. So they weren't granted amnesty, Frank and Jesse. So the Civil War really never ended for them in many respects.
That's true. And the way I often look at Jesse, it reminds me of, you see news stories of wars today with child soldiers. And that's basically what a lot of people were here during the Civil War. And Jesse was, I consider him a child soldier. And that's, during those years, that's gotta change the mindset of a kid, and I guess for the rest of their life in a lot of cases.
Teresa and Daniel Duke, the great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James, and co-authors of The Mysterious Life and Faked Death of Jesse James. Daniel is the author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure and the brand new book, Secret History of the Wild, Wild West. So the first bank robbery credited to the James gang just after the Civil War ended, I guess around February 1866, not only the first robbery accredited to the James gang, it's considered to be the first successful peacetime daylight bank robbery. Tell me about it.
That's true. You want to take that, Teresa?
Well, I know it was just the gang. They were going in to do the robberies, but the robberies weren't for just because they were bank robbers. They had a higher reason, as Danny and me kind of discovered later throughout the research, that they were doing it all for a higher purpose. throughout history, they were, you know, people try to just say, oh, they were just bank robbers, no good bank robbers. But we discovered it was more than just, they were doing it for a higher purpose.
All right. Well, we'll definitely get into that a little bit later. So this was the Liberty Bank robbery. Now, there was some bystanders. Was it this robbery that there were some bystanders killed, or by young bystanders, or was that later?
There was a young man killed. They'd ridden into, you know, and it was, they were still fresh out of the war. They had ridden in. The young man killed was 16 years old, and some say he didn't understand what they were saying. Cole Younger kept telling him to get out of the way. He didn't get out of the way, so Cole Younger shot him. And it was just that matter of fact, cold blooded, you know, he just shot him. They weren't angels by any means, but just trying to, I try to be, you know, remain open-minded about that. But the thing that got me, we went up, we've toured the Liberty Bank. Allegedly afterwards, Jesse had written a letter apologizing and signed the letter, you know, said that they didn't want to kill anyone. It was an accident, et cetera. And he signed it. I asked for, you know, a copy of the letter to see, or just to let me take a photo of it. And they said it upset the owner of the museum so much that he didn't display it. And I thought, that's kind of strange. You have a museum talking all of, you know, where you're telling the story, but the letter upsets you too much. I wanted, my whole goal at that point was just to get an allegedly known sample of Jesse's handwriting to compare it against handwriting that we'd had. We found it later through other means, but that was one of our first attempts. And I just thought that was interesting that they would say a letter would cause him so much pain he didn't want to display it. And this was years later. He'd never even met the guy.
Right.
But
they were descendants. They were the descendants of the young man that was killed during the robbery. They opened up a museum. Was it in a building across the street from the Liberty Bank eventually?
That's right. There's a museum, and we also toured the bank building.
So is it possible they didn't want to display the letter because according to their narrative, Jesse James was not, you know, America's Robin Hood. He was a ruthless killer. They didn't want to muddy the water in terms of their narrative that, you know, here he is showing contrition, showing, you know, regret that this young man was killed, and he actually sent them a letter to apologize.
That's true.
It all depends on the perspective, like you said. You know, some people believe he was a cold-blooded murderer, and others are like, you know, they were kind of forced into this by what was done to them throughout their lives.
Go ahead, Teresa.
Oh, no, like you said, you brought up a good point. It's all on, everyone has their own perspective. Some think he was a cold-blooded killer, and others, you know, view him as a hero.
Right, right. And so there's a rather lengthy list of some of the, you know, I don't know if it's all inclusive. It looks pretty inclusive. All of the banks, the Hughes and Wasson Bank in Richmond, Missouri, May 22nd, 1867. The Nimrod Long and Company Bank, and you list how much money they took. And one was something, I think that Liberty Bank robbery, they took something like, was it 60,000 back in 18.
That was around 60,000. And I also just kind of wanted to clear up one thing. Also, you know, when records also kind of indicate that when that, the cashier was shot and killed, it wasn't like they were directly like aiming the gun to murder him. It was, they were shooting off their guns to create a diversion. So to create chaos so they could get away. And that's when it was like a stray bullet. That's what some research says.
Okay.
There's varying accounts on what actually happened.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure. Then there were the train robberies, the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railroad train robbery in 1873. They took $6,000. Were they also getting gold at this point? Gold coins? Gold ingots?
It's said by some, well, there's a lot of legends claiming that they got, you know, gold bars, gold ingots. I've even had people, other researchers, they didn't have anything to verify this, though. They would claim that there were, you know, Confederate sympathizers in California who would have gold mines, and when they would ship their gold back to the East, they'd let, you know, it was insured. So when the James gang would rob that gold shipment, they would take it, bury it, and the guy who, you know, the original owner got the insurance for it, so that he never really lost anything. So in a way, they were doubling their money. I'd never, that's just one theory, and that wasn't mine. I'd heard that from a couple of other researchers, and it's interesting to think of. I guess it's a possibility. But
when did the we're all familiar with the Pinkerton men. This was after the stagecoaches started getting robbed and the trains getting robbed and banks started getting robbed. You had this, we now know, you know, Pinkerton's as a security firm, but they were, I guess, were they a creation of the banks and the stagecoach companies to go after the robbers? Who formed the Pinkerton men?
Well, the Pinkertons they gained their reputation from, they were, in a sense, Secret Service during the Civil War. Alan Pinkerton was credited with, you know, basically protecting the president and others. They were kind of like a Secret Service before the Secret Service ever existed. And then the Rockefellers would also hire them for different things, which is also where they probably, in some opinions, that's where they entered the stage with the James boys, because interests, moneyed interests around the country were losing money, not only because it had been robbed, but just because people didn't trust the trains to safeguard their belongings, you know, their valuables. And it got so bad at one point, trains started routing around Missouri. They didn't want to go through Missouri because they thought they'd get robbed.
Right. And
like Danny said, a little bit of all of them that kind of like got together and like, hey, we got to stop this.
Right. Yeah. And we're rolling into a break here at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we'll talk about how the Pinkertons targeted the James home and what happened to Zerelda James Samuel, who was Jesse's mother. And that, what happened to her is actually important later in identifying both of you as his great-great-grandchildren. We'll discuss some photographic evidence as well. Teresa and Daniel Duke are with us, the great-great-grandchildren of the legendary American outlaw, train robber, bank robber, stagecoach robber, Jesse James, the authors of The Mysterious Life and Fake Death of Jesse James. Back with more of our conversation right after these.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The truth will set you free. Free. But first, it will really tick you off. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
And we are back with Teresa and Daniel Duke, the great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James, writers, researchers, and they co-wrote The Mysterious Life and Faked Death of Jesse James. Daniel Duke, the author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, and the brand-new book is Secret History of the Wild, Wild West, all available at Amazon. And we were talking about the Pinkertons. They went after the James. Well, I guess by this time, Zerelda had remarried. This was her third marriage to a Samuels, and so it was the Samuels home. Didn't they firebomb the house?
The Pinkertons had been after the James boys, and there was one younger Pinkerton agent had stopped in outside. It was called the Arthur House, Arthur House, and it was like a stable, and they had a diner. He'd stay for the night. And the guy went in that he wanted a meal, and while he was eating, he was bragging about he was going to be the one to help bring the James boys down. Well, the guy he was bragging to who owned the place was W.J. Courtney. He was a former sheriff in Liberty County. Mr. Courtney was also close friends and relatives with the James boys. He allegedly, he served that Pinkerton detective his last meal, because the next day the man was found dead on the side of the road. And a lot of people said, you know, he relayed the message to the James boys or some of his friends, and they killed the agent. It was about a year later. That's when the Pinkertons snuck up to the James farm in the night, allegedly thinking that Jesse and Frank were at the farm, and they threw a bomb. At first it was said it was just Greek fire to light the place up so they could see. Years later, about 20 years ago, a researcher had uncovered documents showing that they knew it was a bomb. They threw the bomb through the window. Zerelda was trying to knock the bomb into the fireplace, you know, just real quick, getting it out of the way, and it exploded. It killed her 9-year-old son, which was Jesse and Frank's half brother, Archie Samuels, and it blew her arm off, and it maimed their stepfather's hand, Dr. Reuben Samuels.
So that Zerelda's missing arm, this is going to be key in sort of establishing that Jesse James is your great-great-grandfather, and we'll get around to that. But I want to just kind of switch gears now and talk about or move ahead to how it is that you established, or I guess your mother, really. Your mother was kind of leading the way in this regard. How she established, first of all, or first learned that Jesse was your great-great-grandfather.
Our late mother, Betty Dorsett Duke, had grown up her whole life hearing the stories that Jesse James was their ancestor and that he'd faked his death and didn't die as history said. And, every time there was a family get together around holidays or anything, those stories were always retold. She grew up believing that, but when she got into high school and she was reading history and, you know, the history book said Jesse was killed, so she wanted to know which was right, the family story or the traditionally accepted story. And she didn't have time. You know, she had me and my brother and sister. And when we got into college, she finally had time to start researching it. And she got all the evidence from the family that she could get and evidence that had been passed down to her, and took the photos. And she was looking at the photos, and, you know, it amazed her that they did look alike, but she knew she needed more than just her word. So she took the photos to the Texas Parks. It was the Texas Department of Public Safety. They're our version of the state police, and at their forensic lab. And their forensic experts had verified that our family photos matched Jesse. Now, known photos of Jesse and historically accepted photos of him and his family members. So she went then to the Austin Police Department forensic photography lab, and they also verified it. She went to a third group called, back then it was
Visionics.
Yeah, Visionics. They were world leaders in facial recognition technology, and they sold their program, you know, their software to government agencies and airports around the world. Well, they also verified that our family photographs matched the historically accepted photographs of Jesse and some of his family members. So we went, you know, she was excited. She thought, okay, that, you know, that's a huge step forward in proving that the family lore was right and traditional history was wrong. And she thought people would be excited about it. So she called the James Farmer Museum in Missouri, and that's the last thing they wanted to hear.
Sure.
That's when walls started going up. Every, you know, anytime you would try to talk to them, they just put a wall up real quick. So
but it wasn't just the faces that they compared, like the photos. They did compare the photos, but it was also there was a photo of Zerelda, and historically accepted photo of Zerelda with a dress on with a certain print. And we found a photo in our collection of his mother with the same print. And we had that examined, and they said that's the same print, same dress. So we had that as well.
Right. So this would be your great-great-great-grandmother who right. was Jesse James' mother, Zerelda, and she had an alias, and we'll explain that in a moment as well. But getting back to the Pinkerton bombing the James farm, and it was her right arm that was taken off, was it?
That was always a point of contention. We knew, like, even with the James farm, they would always ask, which arm was it? Which arm was it? And based on different photographs and the way the clothing, like women's clothing, their buttons are on the left side, whereas men's were traditionally on the right side. And the clothing at the time, we believed it was the left arm. But there's still controversy over that, which when you get, you can go on the internet and find forums where people just fight like cats and dogs over which arm it was. And the point we were trying to get across to them at the time was the faces match. They have the same dress and they're both missing the same arm.
Right. What are the odds that you would have a great-great-grandmother, great-great-great-grandmother, missing an arm, wearing the same style dress, who bears a striking resemblance to Jesse James' mother? Now, in one photograph, wait a minute, your great-great-great-grandmother is missing her left arm, and Zerelda was missing her right arm. But then you discovered that the negative, as often happened, they got reversed, right? It got flipped over. You were able to identify that by the... As you mentioned, the buttons on a woman's dress should be on the left side.
Exactly. And it was a little known facts like that. We would keep digging. It's like, we know it's the same people. I mean, the rest of the family also matches according to forensic experts. So we kept looking, and I remember Mom was like, oh my God, it was reversed. So, and looking at when the buttons were all on the same side, I thought that was, there were a million little keys throughout the years, just little pieces of information like that that would always propel the story forward. But it's interesting how that works out.
Right. So, I mean, you've established in this case that you are the great-great-granddaughters of Zerelda James Samuel and the great-great-grandchildren of Jesse. But then to go from that to establish that Jesse James did not die in 1882 at the hands of Bob Ford, faked his death, took his wealth and his plunder, I guess, if you will, gold and so forth, and lived out his remaining years in Texas. I mean, remaining years, he lived to be almost 100. I mean, that's an entirely different matter, right? That you have to establish that he faked his death Let's start to talk about that. So 1882, April 3rd, set this up for us. Who's Bob Ford and what happened, according to the official narrative?
Okay, Bob and Charlie Ford were allegedly recruited by Jesse James to be a part of his new gang because the old gang had fallen apart after a failed robbery in Northfield, Minnesota. So he was looking for a new gang, this is the official story. He recruited Bob and Charlie Ford. They grew up in the area. There was fighting within the group. There was a guy named Dick Little, and he had supposedly started talking out of fear to the governor. Well, Bob and Charlie Ford were allegedly working undercover for the governor of Missouri, Governor Crittenden, who, by the way, was a distant cousin to Jesse and Frank, I found out later, which blew my mind. But anyway, Crittenden had a reward on their heads just because they wanted, the railroads, all the political reasons and monetary reasons. They were hurting the economy of the entire state. So Bob and Charlie Ford paid, you know, they're working undercover. They were supposed to bring Jesse in dead or alive, and they knew it wouldn't be alive. So according to the official narrative, Jesse, he was in his house under the name of, he was under an alias in St. Joseph, Missouri. He steps up on a stool to dust a photo, a picture, they called it a sampler. It was like home sweet home type thing, embroidered and hung up on the wall. So he's going to dust that off or straighten it. And the accounts vary on that. He steps up on the stool to take care of the sampler, and they shot him in the back of the head. And they run out of the house, went down to the police, you know, the sheriff's office. The sheriff arrests them, and that, you know, that started the whole thing. There was an inquest.
All right, I got to jump in here, Daniel. Pardon the interruption. I got to take a quick time out. We'll come back and pick it up from there. Daniel and Teresa Duke, great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James. Stay with us.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
If it wasn't Jesse James that was shot and killed by Bob Ford, who did he kill?
We believe it was his cousin, Wood Height.
Did he look like Jesse James?
Yes.
Report says that they had similarities in their appearance.
Yeah, they were said to bore a strong resemblance to one another.
But the interesting thing, the reason we believe that we came to believe that it was Wood Height, Wood Height's his cousin, and he was killed, reports say, in December of 1881, but his body wasn't recovered until around a couple days before the Jesse James was reportedly assassinated. So that's when his body was recovered. So it was just weird. What are the odds that Jesse James and his first cousin were both, you know, shot and killed
in allegedly the same manner? There was kind of a love triangle between Bob Ford's sister, Charlie. Bob and Charlie had a sister named Martha Bolton, and she was having an affair with her farmhand, a man named Jim Gibson, and she was also having an affair with Wood Height. And the way the story goes on that, Wood and Jim met at, you know, they were all there at Martha Bolton's house. It was during the winter or early spring, late winter, early spring. They got in a fight, and Wood Height shot Jim and killed him. And there was a big blow up. Wood shot Jim Gibson, the farmhand, and Bob and Charlie, many say it was Bob, shot Wood Height, and the bullet caught him in the back of the head. And then they said they buried him in a shallow grave because the ground was too hard and it was frozen solid, so they couldn't bury him deep. But Jim Gibson, his body is never mentioned, and nobody ever asked where his body was. I mean, he just disappeared from the face, you know, from history at that point. Then, you know, and knowing that Wood bore a strong resemblance, we believe Jesse took that. He didn't plan it. It happened, and they used that as a way to get Jesse, basically for him to fake his death and get off the hook.
So wait a minute. You're saying that they exhumed Wood Height's body, and again, he's buried in winter or late or early spring. So maybe the ground is still frozen, his body's still preserved and presentable enough to look like he was just killed in April of, but then who does Bob Ford actually shoot, or did he shoot anyone?
We believe Bob probably shot Wood Height, but he didn't. We definitely don't believe he shot Jesse James.
No.
We
think it was just a great opportunity for them to, you know, It was presented, his cousin, we believe, Wood Height, and it just was a great time for Jesse to, you know, finally get away from all that, get out of that life.
But just so I'm understanding the timeline here, but Bob Ford, in this part of this lover's spat with he killed Wood Height in maybe early spring or winter, not on April 3rd, 1882. So did he, knowing that he had killed Wood Height and not Jesse James, did he go to the sheriff's department to claim a reward and basically lied, saying, I just killed Jesse James, knowing very well he had killed Wood Height, the cousin.
I believe that's what he did. They had used that opportunity to pass that off. He and Charlie got the reward. I think they thought they would be famous. That blew up again. You know, that didn't go the way they wanted it to. They were painted in history as dirty little cowards, and it didn't go well for Bob and Charlie. But what a lot of people don't realize is, and it's a known fact, Jesse had tried to fake his death in 1879, a couple of years earlier, and with another gang member, they claimed that George Shepard shot him in the back of the head. And George Shepard rode into town, wanting the reward. He said, "I killed Jesse. I'm here for the reward." Well, the sheriff sent out a posse looking for the body, and they never could find a body. So that fell apart, and nobody believed that Jesse had actually died. And then there were a lot of other rumors that Jesse had died. You'd see them in the papers, you know, going just researching the old articles. It got so bad that a journalist from Galveston, Texas, had said, you know, after the alleged killing of Jesse in 1882, the journalist said he'd died so many times nobody believed it anymore. So there was a lot of confusion sown for several years up to that point.
And yeah, it was brilliant.
And one other thing I'd like to say, we went to St. Joseph, Missouri, the house where he was allegedly shot. And if they said he stood on a stool to straighten the sampler. Well, the ceiling was so low, he would have had to have been an extremely short man, like under 5 foot tall, to be able, you know, to have to stand on a stool to straighten a sampler in that room, which was, I just wanted to point that out. He was, even a short man would have been able to have done that without standing on a stool. But I think they said that to try to explain away the reason he was shot at the angle he was in the back of the head.
Ah, right, right. So your great-great-grandfather had started using an alias like something like 16 years before he was supposedly killed in 1882. Was it just the one alias, James Lafayette Courtney, or did he use other aliases?
He was known to have used other aliases, but that was the alias he lived under in Texas. There's probably aliases he used that we may never know. And then there's a lot of variations of aliases, but a lot of the men, even men who didn't go into outlawry, former Quantrell's guerrillas, for example, they changed their names because they didn't want to get hunted down and killed like a lot of their former comrades had.
So maybe Teresa, I'll get you to handle this one. There was a real James Lafayette Courtney, right? That your great great granddad took his name, but who was the real James Courtney? Do we know?
Well, he believes that. They were related to the real James L. Courtney. And they records indicate that he was a Union soldier, a bugler. What was it, Danny? A bugler in the Union Army. But, we believe that that's how, you know, he knew of the James L. Courtney, and that's how they had a lot of connections with the Courtneys. They had neighbors who were Courtneys. They were related to the Courtneys. And we just believe that's an opportunity presented itself. And he took on that alias.
And there were a lot of that side of the family would change their name from Courtney to Hahn and Andrus. And they had changed their name several times. And it was hard following the name changes. If we hadn't had family records and letters from all of them, or from most of them, it would have been near impossible to figure it all out.
So before your mother, Betty, sort of connected the dots and realized that your great-great-granddad was Jesse James, it was presumed that your great-great-grandfather's name was James Lafayette Courtney, and your great-great-great-grandmother was not Zerelda James Samuel, but Diana Andrus Courtney. Is that right?
That's right.
Correct.
So Jesse's mother also changed her name? Did she move to Texas with him, or how did she come to have that alias?
Zerelda, actually, that wasn't Zerelda's alias. That was James Lafayette Courtney's mother was, you know, Diana Andrus Courtney. And they had moved to Tennessee, whereas Jesse's mother stayed in Missouri. She would travel. In fact, when she died, she was on her way back from Texas to Missouri and died on a train. And, you know, she was an elderly lady at the time, but she traveled to Texas quite a bit. We even have a photo of her at Jesse's farm in Blevins, Texas, where when Frank married Annie Ralston.
And Frank was Jesse's brother.
We just have about a minute here. I just want to touch on this, and we'll continue this conversation into hour two with Teresa and Daniel Duke and take calls at the bar or calls or questions from the live chat at the bottom of the next hour. There's a photograph in the book of Jesse James at his own funeral. Tell me about that.
Rumors always persisted. People said that Jesse James attended his own funeral, but we can never find proof of that until one night we were just, you know, doing our research, and we came across this picture that said Jesse James's funeral, and it was a picture of Grandpa Courtney with his mom and Frank in the picture. So we believe we have a picture that proves he didn't attend his own funeral. So we were always trying to put that rumor to rest to see if he really did attend it or if he didn't. And we believe we found the picture that said that he did it actually attend his own funeral.
Wow, that's pretty brazen.
You can listen to part two of my conversation with Daniel and Teresa Duke, great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James, next time right here on Strange Planet.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at StrangePlanetPodcast.com.